This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. And yes, it really is me. This new sound should be temporary. Luckily for you, most of today's show was recorded late last week. Later this hour, you'll hear from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution's outgoing president, Susan Avery. She took over in 2008 as the recession was beginning. She spoke with WCAI's Elsa Partan about the work she's done to leave the institution stronger and the challenges that still remain. And speaking of challenges, our region's energy system is facing its fair share, maybe more. News director Sean Corcoran joins me to talk about WCAI's in-depth series on the future of electricity in New England. But first, author Bill Sargent talks about his book, Islands in the Storm. Sargent is the author of several books about environmental issues, including the Gulf oil spill and the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Of late, though, his attention has been focused on the impacts of climate change on our coasts. His latest book looks at how vulnerable island communities along the Atlantic and Gulf shores are coping with encroaching seas. I spoke with Bill Sargent from his home north of Boston.
Bill Sargent, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Erosion has been the focus of a lot of your writing in recent years. Why is it? What about this topic keeps drawing you back?
Well, I think it's the fastest horse of the environmental apocalypse, if you will. It's something that you can see in an area like Chatham. You know, you might be losing a house every month. On Plum Island, you could be losing a house every week. So it's, you know, a lot of things like, you know, ice disappearing in the Arctic is fairly distant, and it's not happening rapidly enough so that the average person can see it. But if it's in your own backyard and houses are falling into the ocean, then it's pretty apparent.
You write in your new book, Islands in the Storm, quote, "The first of the heat-induced storms destroyed our vulnerable low-lying cities like well-placed nuclear bombs." You reference Hurricane Andrew, Hurricane Katrina. I'm curious about your choice of words, though. Do you really think it's warranted to call these heat-induced storms? I mean, there seems to be a lot of science suggesting that climate change is making storms stronger, perhaps, but we've always had hurricanes.
We've always had hurricanes. I think there is some indication that because the oceans are warmer now, you could have stronger hurricanes. I think actually what's even more important than that, you know, for us in New England, is because the water is warmer, we're also getting stronger northeasters. And as we know up here, it's the northeasters that do the most damage.
So you go on to write, "If a foreign nation had devastated three of our major cities, we would know how to respond. It seems to be hardwired into our primate genes. But how do you respond to something invisible that helped build our civilizations and accumulated slowly over the past three centuries?" You go on to question whether we're really psychologically capable of facing the realities of climate change. And that seems to be kind of the crux of this whole book. Can we actually psychologically cope with climate change?
Yeah, I think it is. One of the things that's interesting to me about this book is most of my other writing about erosion has been on Cape Cod or in, you know, New Orleans or in other parts of the country. What's interesting here, in most of the other areas, the government agencies and the elected officials eventually come out, you know, line up with the science. Here, the whole community has sort of been complicit in avoiding the science and making, you know, the absolutely the worst decisions you could make about what to do with a barrier beach.
Well, you actually open the book with Atlantic City, which you say is textbook example of what not to do. So what would you say Atlantic City has been doing incorrectly in coping with this issue?
Well, they've done everything. You know, they've built a series of groins, they've built seawalls, and they've built jetties. And these are the three worst things that you can do to a barrier beach. And interestingly enough, they're the three things that they've been doing on Plum Island as well.
What makes them the worst things that you can do for a barrier beach?
Well, what they do is they actually increase the amount of erosion. They speed it up. And of course, they're expensive. And so once you start going down that trail, you have to keep going. So if you build one groin, it will collect sand on the upstream side, but it increases the amount of erosion on the downstream side. So then your neighbor has to build a groin. You know, each one of these might be, you know, cost $10,000, and then the next guy has to, and the next guy has to. So you'll see, you know, the New Jersey shore, you might see 50 or 60 groins that are all sticking out like, you know, like toothpicks out from the beach.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Sargent. He's talking about his new book, Islands in the Storm. Bill, a lot of this book focuses on Plum Island, very close to where you live. And in 2012, you wrote rather controversially that Plum Island, you know, just north of Boston, had reached a point of no return. What was your basis for that?
Well, basically, what's happening with Plum Island, and it's happening on a lot of beaches, is that they're running out of their reservoir of sand. In other words, the sand on Plum Island built up over thousands and thousands of years as the glaciers were retreating. And now most of that sand has been washed out of the center of the island to make the barrier beach longer and longer. And this, you know, we're very familiar with this on Cape Cod. So we're running out of that reserve of sand. So once you reach a certain tipping point, you don't have enough sand in the system to keep building your barrier beach.
Is that loss of sand on Plum Island just part of the natural process of being a barrier beach, of barrier beaches constantly moving? Or is this something that's been exacerbated by, as you mentioned, building seawalls and groins and human development on the island?
Yeah, it's been exacerbated. As a matter of fact, I mean, people look at this as a natural disaster, the way we initially looked at New Orleans as a national disaster after Katrina. But then you look a little bit closer, and it's actually a man-made disaster because we've been doing all these things that make things worse.
How much damage did Hurricane or Superstorm, I guess we should say, Sandy, do on Plum Island?
It was the initial storm, and it didn't do that much explicit damage right at the beginning. What it did do is, in preparation for that, a lot of the homeowners got permission to scrape the beach. And that means they took bulldozers down and they scraped the sand off of the low tide area and simply build up an artificial dune in front of their houses. And so the dune was probably about 40 feet in height. And what happened is the first high tide came through and it took away the first 30 feet of sand because it was unconsolidated sand. And then because they had scraped the beach, it sort of had a funneling effect so that the next high tide took an additional 10 feet out. And so after the storm, you know, you came by and there were houses that had stairs dangling, you know, 40 feet in the air, that those stairs had been coming down to the dune, and then now the dune was gone. So that was the beginning storm, and then we had four other storms, and it was the March storm where all the houses tumbled into the ocean.
How many homes have been lost on Plum Island at this point?
Well, since 2008, there've been about nine houses lost. About 40 were condemned. One was moved across to the other side of the street. And all of these, the houses that were condemned, people will be, people are living in them now. And a lot of the houses have been rebuilt on exactly the same footprint as before. And they're actually even building new houses in the dunes where they really shouldn't be building them.
You come from a science background, and clearly in just the way you've spoken about Atlantic City and now Plum Island, do not believe that we are living sustainably on our coastlines. But one thing that you have done on Plum Island and before that with homeowners in Chatham on Cape Cod is really almost embed yourself in these communities, get to know the homeowners, get to know the people going through this process as these coastal communities are really at these tipping points and really starting to disappear. What is your relationship with those homeowners like? How tense a relationship is that?
actually, I get along very well with all, and I like all the people on Plum Island. I think that's the best way to tell the story. I wrote one book that I started down in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and then I went up the East Coast and along the Gulf Coast looking at coastal problems. And it was just sort of looking at the concept of erosion. And frankly, it didn't work very well. I think it's you write a much better story if you write about a single community and get into the details. And again, I think, you know, coming from a scientific background, that's the way you do science. You break down a problem and look at it in detail, and then you make inferences from what you found from that particular case study.
Has anything that you have seen in the past 2 years changed your attitude or your assessment of Plum Island's future?
I think things are happening much faster than I thought they would. As a matter of fact, just in this past week, people have realized that one of the things that they did is they spent about $12 million to repair the jetty off of the Merrimack River. And the idea for that was that it would slow down the erosion for some of the houses about a half a mile away, which actually made no sense. But what it did do is it has directed the sand that normally naturally comes down the beach and protects the houses and shoots it off into the deep water. So it's no longer in the system. And because of that, the sand can't get around the point, so there's a very rapid erosion occurring on the north end of the island. So there's a community of several hundred people that are now very vulnerable, and probably we'll see some major effects this winter.
I want to touch on another community that's facing similar issues, and that's on Nantucket, the Sconset Beach community. Really, their situation has been in the news a lot this fall as they're trying to put down these barriers of a sort to stop the headland eroding there, a number of houses in danger of being lost into the ocean. What about that situation? You talk about that a little bit in the book. How do you see that situation playing out?
Well, there's a couple of interesting differences. One is the amount of money that we're talking about. You probably have the equivalent of the gross national product of several Central American communities or countries on that one strip of beach. And I think they're thinking of spending close to $24 million to build a series of mattresses to try to slow things down, which again probably won't work. What's interesting to me is everybody is lined up where they make sense on Nantucket. In other words, all the guys who you expect to be wearing the white hats are wearing the white hats, and the guys you expect to be wearing the black hats are wearing the black hats. So the Conservation Commission is against this project. A lot of the local officials are against the project, and obviously it's the homeowners are for it. That's exactly the opposite on Plum Island, where some of the local conservation commissions and the state officials and the local officials are lined up behind doing some of these things that they shouldn't be doing.
And you think that's a factor of the wealth in the community?
No, I think it's pure politics. There happen to be a couple very good politicians who have, created this organization. It's called the Merrimack River Beach Users Alliance. And they've been the one that has been driving the whole system and getting the money for the Army Corps of Engineers and convincing them to do these things. They also, the seawalls that people built are all illegal, and the state tried to turn them down, And they made a quick call to an organization called the Pacific Legal Foundation, which is one of the largest anti-environmental groups in the country. And they called the state, and the state backed down within a half an hour. And so they got to build the seawall. And now we're finding, just since the past storm, that seawall is starting to collapse. And there's a couple houses that are, you know, just being held up by, right now, by a tiny little column of tiles that people have built under one corner of their foundation.
You mentioned earlier that in the book you went up and down the East Coast and the Gulf Coast looking at a number of different island communities. Did you find examples where you think communities are coming together, officials and homeowners are coming together to do the right thing, in your view?
Well, yes. And actually, we saw that, you know, quite a bit after Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, it's interesting there because, you know, New York has taken one tact and New Jersey has taken the other. The same thing actually happened after Katrina, where Louisiana took one track and Mississippi took the other track. So up here in New York, people have been given federal funds. They've essentially, the federal government has come in and bought these people out and paid them the fair market value of their houses so that they could retreat inland. What they've done in New Jersey, it said, no, you can't get reimbursed unless you rebuild on exactly the same footprint as before. So now you're seeing some, you know, beaches that are in pretty good shape in New York, and in New Jersey, you still see, you know, whole communities where their houses have been abandoned and they're, you know, filling up with fungus and it's quite a mess. They have a lot of work to do.
You in the book write about the difference between living on the coast, right next to the water, as opposed to close to the coast, and talk about your own personal experiences in both of those positions. What to you is the value of living right on the coast?
Well, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today if I didn't grow up right on the water. I grew up on Pleasant Bay down in Orleans. And your day is very different. You know, you wake up in the morning and you look out and you might see some fish, are jumping and you might go crabbing for the day, or you might get clams or whatever is happening on the water you do. And of course, you know, I was very fortunate as a kid. I didn't have to take tennis lessons or all the things that kids have to do today. I had a little boat with a 3 horsepower motor, and I would go out and I'd spend all day, just out poking around, getting familiar with the bay and becoming intrigued with the biology, particularly of the area. And I think kids miss those experiences now.
So how do we balance then what you see as a value added of living on the coast? Clearly, coastal life draws a lot of other people. How do we balance that desire to be next to the water with what you're saying essentially we need to do is back away from the coast if we're going to live sustainably? How do we balance those two?
Well, you know, I think nature is doing it for us. That's certainly the case on Plum Island. Most of the dunes have been depopulated just in the last few years. So, you had a strip of houses sort of tooth by jowl up on the top of the dunes, and you couldn't really even see the ocean if you were behind the houses. And now, you know, there are huge gaps. Now you can see out to the ocean. And so I think the community is faced with the decision whether they want to have essentially a recreational beach community, or they want to have it as a residence on the beaches. And, you know, a lot of the neighboring towns, like I live in Ipswich, and we have a beautiful beach called Cranes Beach, and they removed some of the houses. There were some farms that were out there. And now they get actually a lot more money from people coming and parking and going to the beach than they would be getting from the tax revenues from the houses that were out there.
I wonder if you see lessons that these island and coastal communities might be able to teach all of us, whether we live near the coast or not, about changing our attitude perhaps towards the environment, towards climate change, and I hesitate to use the kind of cliched phrase, finding a way to live in harmony with nature, but certainly trying to find a way to have a less combative attitude towards some of these forces of nature.
Well, I think everybody is beginning to come around to that, and they realize that you can't fight nature. That's what we've been trying to do for the last, 50 or 100 years by doing things like, putting up seawalls and jetties and groynes and sort of hard armoring the coast. And now I think we're beginning to learn that you have to live with nature. And particularly the Dutch have been very good about this. And actually, I have a very close friend who lives in Salem, and she has a company that did all the re-engineering work in New Orleans after Katrina, and it was all done on what are called bioengineering principles. In other words, they replanted the marshes, they built up some of the islands. They had natural levees, and they did all of these things working with nature and trying to redirect the water away from where it was going to do the damage. And, I think more and more communities are starting to think along these lines.
That's Bill Sargent, author of the new book, Islands in the Storm. Bill, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure.
Up next, outgoing president of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Susan Avery, talks about her legacy and the financial challenges facing our science institutions. That's after a short break.